Welcome to Hour 1 of the Arizona Republic for Friday, November 22nd, 2024. I'm your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Joe Napoli. Today's cover page features a story about Guadalupe, Santa Cruz County, and goings-on in Washington, D.C. Our lead story today is titled, How a Tiny Valley Town Could Go Broke. Guadalupe's latest crisis, largely of its own making, by Sam Kamak and Maritza Dominguez. Guadalupe, a town of about 5,300 that spans less than 1 square mile, wedged between Phoenix and Tempe, has faced challenges before in its 50-year history. Now it faces another big one. It could go broke in 6 years. Guadalupe, which was incorporated in 1975, is overwhelmingly inhabited by Latinos and Pascua-Yaqui tribe members, many descended from those who fled to the town in the early 1900s to avoid persecution in Mexico. It is bounded by Interstate 10 to the west, the South Broadway Highline Lateral Canal to the north and east, and Calle Carmen and Middle Road to the south. Priest Drive becomes Avenida del Yaqui as it forms the spine of the tiny community. For the families who have called Guadalupe home for nearly a century, it's the place where their culture and traditions thrive within one of the nation's largest metro areas. To many outsiders, the town is synonymous with poverty, heavy-handed immigration raids, and illegal racial profiling by Maricopa County Sheriff's deputies under Joe Arpaio. But the latest crisis is one largely of the town's own making, deepened, complicated, and made harder to reverse by circumstances beyond its control. Guadalupe spends an average of $1 million more than it earns each year. If nothing changes, it's slated to run out of money in 2031. And there's no clear solution in sight. The town is boxed in by its geography, a small tax base, dependence on outside funds, demands for public service, and limited options for cutting spending. Guadalupe raised worker pay over the past 3 years to a level that may be unaffordable, but it has so few employees that layoffs could cripple services the town has to provide. Most of the budget goes toward necessities like public safety. Meanwhile, it has few sustainable revenue streams to fund basic functions. It relies on state revenue, which is subject to political whim, and resident sales taxes, which can leak into neighboring communities. With almost no shops in the town, residents go to Tempe and Phoenix for supplies. Guadalupe also relies on limited funding streams and one-time grants from outside the community to cover infrastructure maintenance. That drains hundreds of thousands of dollars from the town's already overstretched coffers. Most cities in the valley charge property taxes to pay for such expenses. Even if Guadalupe pursued every financial preservation policy that's currently on the table, town projections show we would still be spending significantly more than it could afford. Financial records and interviews with town officials show the community has frequently danced on the edge of financial catastrophe, yet somehow managed to stay afloat. Most recently, it averted financial disaster thanks to unforeseen millions of dollars of COVID-19 relief funds. In Guadalupe's history, it's kind of a common thing, extreme fiscal struggles, Guadalupe town manager Jeff Kluga said. This has been a problem for decades. Out of balance, more going out than coming in. Guadalupe's financial troubles lie with how it manages its general fund, the pot of money local governments use for basic functions, such as paying staff and funding public safety. Kluga describes it as the backbone of the town's finances. The general fund is expected to take in about $6.5 million in revenue this year. Nearly all of that comes from local sales taxes and state revenues that are shared with local governments throughout Arizona. That's nowhere near enough to cover the $8.7 million in general fund spending that's budgeted for the same time frame. However, so the town has to pull from its savings, which will soon be depleted, to cover those extra costs. Most communities would look simply to cut back on spending, but that is not entirely practical for Guadalupe. The town has fewer than 24 full-time employees, and about 55% of the budget goes to fund necessities like public safety, which includes its policing contract with the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office. Guadalupe has beefed up staffing in the town over the past decade. It currently has about 18 full-time employees, twice as many as it did in 2010, and they have received between 3 and 5% raises in each of the past 3 years. Those raises increase the town's total employee costs, including benefits and salary, to $2.7 million this year from $1.6 million in 2020. That increase is roughly equal to Guadalupe's projected general fund deficit. The average salary for a town employee was $65,000 in 2020. Today, it's $106,000, or about twice the average household income for Guadalupe residents, or about $20,000 more than typical household gross income across Maricopa County, according to U.S. Census figures from 2022. Those figures also include Kaluga, who earns about $170,000 as both a town manager and clerk. For context, Tempe City Manager makes $315,000 as a base salary, and that city's clerk made about $130,000 as a base salary in 2023. Kaluga also said firefighter overtime pay, which is expected to cost Guadalupe about $172,000 this year, could be skewing the average salary figure for town workers. I know people that look at that and say, "Really? You're doing that when you've got some budget deficits?" Kaluga said about the wages. But you can't compete with the other communities. So how do you retain good people if you're not offering them a decent wage with some benefits? Kaluga remains hopeful that the town can stem its financial bleeding. He's proposed measures such as paying off Guadalupe's public safety pension debt to save on interest costs, creating a property tax, and axing minor expenses such as toner for printing. All that can reduce the budget shortfall by half, but that still leaves $500,000 to come up with every year to break even. Guadalupe keeps chugging along with financial challenges, but we're still trying to deliver services that have value to the community, Kaluga said. We're chipping away, living on the edge of collapse, Guadalupe's history of financial struggles. Guadalupe Mayor Valeria Molinera was elected to the seat in 2016 with the ambition to bring more life and fix up deteriorating areas of the town. What she found was a town on the brink of financial ruin and the need to turn it around. One of the first things she did was hire Kaluga, who had previously helped manage city finances in Scottsdale and Tempe. Almost immediately, the new town manager saw problems, and he told the Arizona Republic that the issues had existed since at least 2008. I got here on October 17, 2017. We had $800,000 in our general fund reserve. You go back years previous to that, there was deficit spending, said Kaluga, who described Guadalupe's financial struggles as structural, with the town's operating spending chronically outpacing its revenue model. The structural imbalance was reaching a tipping point in 2018. Kaluga's five-year forecast that year, Guadalupe was on track to run out of money by 2023. But then came the COVID-19 pandemic in 2020. Guadalupe was one of the hardest hit cities in the Metro Phoenix area, but the flood of state and federal funding delayed the town's financial crisis. Molina said, the Pascua Yaqui tribe helped support the town during COVID by paying for a bulk of the items we needed, so that allowed the town not to use their reserves. Guadalupe received more than $3 million in COVID relief funding through the Pascua Yaqui tribe in 2023 alone. Kaluga was able to use that cash for certain infrastructure improvements that, in ordinary circumstances, would have been funded with general fund dollars. We could utilize those funds for frontline services, particularly public safety, our senior center. We were able to use those to augment some of our funding and savings, he said, adding that funding also went toward health-related projects, like replacing air conditioning systems which would otherwise come from the general fund. Guadalupe emerged from the pandemic with more than $6 million in general fund reserves, or nearly seven times the financial cushion it had before COVID struck. It only delayed Kaluga's 2018 production reaching fruition. Today, those COVID relief dollars are drying up. The town's deficit is rapidly chewing away at that $6 million general fund padding, and Guadalupe is once again staring into a financial black hole. The structural imbalance, few revenue streams, and little to cut. Multiple factors make Guadalupe's economic situation unique in the metro area. About 90% of Guadalupe's general fund revenue comes from sales taxes and state revenue. The former is expected to generate about $3.4 million this year, while the latter is budgeted to bring in roughly $2.2 million. The town does not have a property tax, even though it is a mostly residential area, with only a handful of businesses that generate sales taxes. And those businesses don't include certain essentials, like a grocery store or pharmacy. Guadalupe's sales tax rate is the highest of any city or town in the valley, however, is between 3% and 5%, depending on the type of business doing the sale. When Guadalupe residents leave the 0.8 square mile town to shop, their sales tax dollars fill the coffers of other cities, not Guadalupe's. But the town still needs to provide services for residents, such as police and fire, which overwhelmingly comprise Guadalupe's biggest annual costs. This year, the town expects to spend about $2.6 million on its contract with the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office and $2.3 million on its fire department. Combined, those two items account for about 55% of the town's $8.7 million general fund budget. Both of those are our biggest expenses. You cannot cut without looking at those, Kaluga said. How else do we drop upwards of 15% to 20%? The town manager said the cost of the sheriff's contract consistently increases year over year, but that's the cheapest option available to keep law enforcement in Guadalupe. We asked around a number of agencies, and then I asked a couple of my buddies, a police chief who happened to be a city manager, so he knew both worlds. He said, "You're not getting a bad deal," said Kaluga, who added that he received the same answer from the multiple police chiefs he asked. Guadalupe's fire department is largely the same. The town manager said he explored contracting with some of the town's bordering communities to provide that service in Guadalupe, but there was a lack of interest or it would be more expensive. Kaluga said the department is comprised of a chief and six firefighters. All of them are paid because having a volunteer force, even a town as small as Guadalupe, is no longer doable, according to Kaluga. With the amount of hazardous waste risk and COVID and all that, who wants to voluntarily expose themselves to that? Then somehow, 3 years later, their kid gets cancer. Was that connected? The liability and all that? I think those days are going away. After emergency services, infrastructure projects take up the largest chunk of Guadalupe's general fund spending this year. More than $800,000 goes to those projects, or about a tenth of the overall general fund budget. In cities like Tempe and Phoenix, infrastructure projects are often funded through bond programs. Voters there give the cities permission to take on bond debt, which the local government then pays back over multiple decades through a secondary property tax. Because Guadalupe doesn't finance its projects that way, the town has to decide between three options. Let infrastructure deteriorate, implement a secondary property tax to finance those projects, or throw general fund dollars it can't afford to spend at the problem. Guadalupe has, by and large, chosen the latter. Not fiscally sustainable. What's next for Guadalupe? Kaluga didn't mince words in the town's budget documents or doing town presentations about the seriousness of the town's financial future. The town of Guadalupe's current budget and projected five-year forecast is not fiscally sustainable, he wrote. The town is on track to spend roughly $1 million more each year over the next 5 years than it makes in general fund revenue, according to Kaluga's forecast at the November 14th council meeting. That figure is down from the $1.6 million in October, however. Kaluga said the Arizona Department of Revenue found more sales tax revenue during a budget reconciliation with Guadalupe, which is a process where financial books are compared to correct any errors. He didn't give any more information about that situation, but said the department found roughly $600,000 in underreported sales tax revenue. Guadalupe also recently received a $452,000 grant from Maricopa County Board of Supervisors Steve Gallardo's office, which Kaluga said will be used to repave the town hall parking lot. That cost would have otherwise been borne by the general fund. And Kaluga recently struck a less expensive health care package for town employees that's expected to save the town about $175,000 annually. The town manager's two most substantive proposals to further reduce the gap include creating a townwide property tax and paying off the town's police pension debt, which will save Guadalupe roughly $200,000 in interest payments over the next 15 years. The former would only bring about $125,000 of extra revenue a year, partly because the Pascua-Yaqui tribe owns multiple properties in the town and they are exempt from such taxes. We are not a reservation, but they own a huge portion of what is in town, and that is why when we look at property tax, a lot of their properties would be exempt, Molina said. We know that generating a property tax would not be enough because all of the community houses and facilities that are basically going to be ineligible. Even if both Kaluga's two proposals were adopted, it wouldn't balance Guadalupe's budget. The town manager said if he can get the gap down to around $500,000, it would be in the manageable arena. It's not clear how the town would snuff out that remaining deficit. Kaluga told the Republic that the main idea on the table right now is ginning up more economic development, although the specifics of what that may look like are uncertain. Saving Guadalupe. Now, Molina and Kaluga will need to make their case to residents about why these changes are desperately needed and the consequences if the town can't pull itself out. At its worst, the town would have to shut the doors to town hall, cut all its services except for the bare minimum like public safety, and only have an employee who can pay the bills, Molina told the Republic. Services like the senior center or community action program would be gone, she said. There wouldn't be an employee to apply for grants or someone to enforce codes. When we broke it down, it was the only people that would be around, someone to pay the bills, to make sure the streetlights would be paid for, and the water bills would be paid for. That's it, Molina said. But that's not what she wants. Instead, she's trying to get the message across to her community to take an interest. Carlos Valencia, a resident of the town and owner of Yaqui Pride, says he hopes the town can pull itself out of the situation. Valencia, 45, moved back to Guadalupe when he purchased a house with his wife. He realized now he was the adult who had to help figure out how the town could sustain itself. We need to make Guadalupe a good place for our kids. We're the ones that have to make the decisions now, he said. How to do that, he doesn't know yet, he said. But he wants to see his neighbors and community be more involved by volunteering, coaching their kids' sports teams, or help planning town events. When the Pascua-Yaqui tribe has been a partner of the town and supporter, Valencia said the town and community need to step up to find a way to be sustainable. We can't necessarily just think, oh, that tribe is going to save us, Valencia said. Adin Guadalupe is going to have to figure out for itself how it can survive. That was from an article titled, How a Tiny Valley Town Could Go Broke. If you miss a program or just want to listen to it on demand, you can get it through our website at sunsounds.org/broadcastinfo and audio on demand. Our next article is titled, Ex-County Treasurer Enters Plea. Santa Cruz official is accused of embezzling by Sarah Lapidus. Former Santa Cruz County Treasurer Elizabeth Gutfahr on Thursday pleaded guilty to 3 federal felony charges stemming from accusations she embezzled nearly $40 million from the county for over 10 years. The U.S. Attorney for the District of Arizona and the U.S. Department of Justice on Tuesday filed charges alleging Gutfahr committed 3 felonies, embezzlement by a public official, money laundering, and tax evasion. Gutfahr indicated in court documents she would plead not guilty, but reverse course in a Thursday court appearance. A sentencing hearing is scheduled for February. Defendant Guthfar used millions of dollars of stolen money she deposited into the Wells Fargo and BMO accounts for gross personal enrichment, including, but not limited to, the purchase of real property, prosecutors allege, in documents filed in U.S. District Court. Prosecutors allege she also used stolen funds to pay for her business's expenses and veterinary bills, in addition to purchasing numerous vehicles, including Jeeps, Ford trucks, a Mercedes-Benz, Cadillacs, and an Airstream touring coach. Prosecutors allege Guthfar stole $38.7 million from the county, transferred it to bank accounts of fake companies to avoid paying income tax, and concealed a source of income when she directed wire transfers from the county accounts. Prosecutors allege, as of January 25th, the Arizona Department of Economic Security had no record of her business with the name Rio Rico Real Estate and Consulting. It was also not registered with the Arizona Corporation Commission, nor was it assigned an employer identification number with the Internal Revenue Service. Another one of her businesses, Rio Rico Consulting LLC, was not found during a search of the Arizona Corporation Commission's business database, prosecutors say. Federal prosecutors also say Guthfar fraudulently wired 187 money transfers over 10 years to buy multiple properties and remodel her Rancho San Jacinto home. She is also accused of tax evasion and allegedly owes $13.1 million in taxes. Criminal charges follow civil lawsuit. The federal charges come 3 months after the county filed a civil lawsuit against her following an alert in April by the county's bank. JPMorgan Chase reported 11 fraudulent transactions for $375,000 to the county. The findings prompted the Federal Bureau of Justice, Department of Justice, Arizona Auditor General's Office, and Santa Cruz County investigations. Prosecutors allege Guthfar successfully avoided detection for a decade by fabricating investment statements, misrepresenting the total balance of funds in finance reports, and diverting money in certain months. During the annual audit by the Arizona Auditor General, the state agency reviewed June year-end financial statements in the preceding year, so Guthfar avoided diverting funds in June and July, prosecutors allege. She also reportedly concealed the wire transfers by circumventing a two-step approval process by using a computer token assigned to the county's chief deputy to initiate wire transfers that Guthfar would then approve. Guthfar reportedly told the chief deputy her Wells Fargo account was a county savings account used to earn interest to the county. Guthfar fraudulently used the Rio Rico Real Estate and Consulting name on the Wells Fargo account and the business name Rio Rico Consulting LLC on the BMO account to conceal the embezzlement of public funds by making it appear that the transfers had a legitimate business purpose for the county, state court documents. Who is Elizabeth Guthfar? Guthfar, a Democrat, was elected in 2012. She was re-elected in 2016 and 2020 and planned to run unopposed in the 2024 election until the county sued her over the alleged embezzlement. Before becoming a county treasurer, she worked in real estate. Real estate records show Guthfar held a real estate broker license that was issued in 2008 and expired in 2012 with an associated business named Rio Rico Real Estate and Consulting. That's the business that prosecutors say was wrapped up in the alleged embezzlement. You can reach the reporter at sarah.lapidus@gannett.com. The Republic's coverage of Southern Arizona is funded in part with a grant from Report for America. Support Arizona news coverage with a tax-deductible donation at supportjournalism.azcentral.com. That article was Ex-County Treasurer Enters Plea. We finished the front page today with an article out of Washington, D.C., titled Gates Drops His AG Bid Amid Sex Drug Scandal, by Riley Began and Joey Garrison of USA Today. Former Representative Matt Gaetz, Republican of Florida, withdrew his nomination Thursday to be President-elect Donald Trump's Attorney General. Gaetz wrote on X that he had excellent meetings with senators Wednesday and said the momentum was strong for his candidacy. but it is clear that my confirmation was unfairly becoming a distraction to the critical work of the Trump-Vance transition, Gates wrote. There is no time to waste on a needlessly protracted Washington scuffle, thus I'll be withdrawing my name from consideration to serve as Attorney General. Republican senators have been hounded about Gates' nomination since Trump announced he planned to appoint him last week. The party will control the U.S. Senate, 53-47, next year. Nonetheless, it became clear there were not enough Republicans willing to support the controversial nominee, whose bid to lead the Justice Department was marked by allegations that he had trafficked minors for sex. The Justice Department, which Gates would have led as Attorney General, investigated allegations the Florida Republican committed statutory rape by paying for sex with a 17-year-old girl and for her to travel with him across state lines. That probe was dropped without charges. The House committee investigating sexual misconduct allegations against Gates obtained records detailing $10,000 in payments the former Florida congressman made to two women who were later witnesses in the panel's probe, according to multiple media reports. Documents under review by the House Ethics Committee, first reported by ABC News and later the Washington Post, outlined 27 payments Gates made through Venmo and PayPal between July 2017 and January 2019, totaling $10,224 to the two witnesses. Both women were older than the age of 18 at the time of the payments, ABC reported. The New York Times on Wednesday reported federal investigators traced Gates' payments by creating a convoluted web-like diagram featuring thumbnail photos of Gates and several men and women to show how he transferred payments through intermediaries to the women. The House Ethics Committee, a bipartisan panel equally divided between Democrats and Republicans, was also investigating those and other allegations. It had planned to vote on whether to release a report on their findings just 2 days after Gates abruptly resigned his House seat last week upon receiving the Trump nomination. The House typically does not release findings on former members, though Democrats on the panel advocated for the report to be made public. One witness said she saw Gates reportedly under the influence of drugs and sexually abusing the 17-year-old, though she said she did not think Gates knew the girl's age. Gates has denied the allegations. It's unclear whether Gates, who was re-elected, will retake his spot in the House in January. We now turn to the Valley and State page, where the lead article is titled, Law Forces City Shift on Casita Rules, Multiple Guest Houses on Lots to Become Easier. Phoenix approved new casita regulations that make it easier for property owners to build multiple guest houses on their lots and use them as short-term rentals. Council members begrudgingly approved the changes on Wednesday to comply with state law. Phoenix had already legalized casitas in September, but in May, the legislature passed a new law that legalized casitas statewide, although it exempts some other cities. The law authorized property owners to build multiple casitas on one lot and banned cities from disallowing guest houses to be used as short-term rentals. This went against Phoenix's ordinance that allowed one casita per single-family home and banned property owners from listing them on sites like Airbnb or Vrbo. Councilmembers said they wanted the casitas to help mitigate the housing shortage by being used for adult-age children who can't afford an apartment or for older generations on fixed incomes. Without that prohibition, we are not really addressing the housing issues and needs here in our community, Councilwoman Keisha Hodge-Washington said on Wednesday. Phoenix Mayor Kate Gallego in October contrasted the city and state policies, saying, the city's policy focused on housing, the state allowed party houses. What's different about casita regulations now? The changes mean Phoenix homeowners can build two accessory dwelling units per lot instead of one. Homeowners can build a third ADU if the lot is at least 1 acre, and one if the ADU is considered affordable housing. Phoenix will no longer require the same design review standards that required an ADU match the exterior design, roof pitch, or finishing materials of the single-family dwelling, city documents said. Council members blast legislature for punitive measure. On Wednesday, and at an October policy session, the mayor and council rebuked state lawmakers for the Casita law. They said it did more to create party houses than solve the housing shortage and strip the voice of city residents who helped craft Phoenix's Casita ordinance. The net effect was punishing Phoenix, a city that council members say has worked diligently and done more than other Valley cities to solve the housing crisis. Council members pointed to data Phoenix officials shared publicly last week that showed Phoenix had more land zoned for multifamily housing than any other cities in the valley. 20% of Phoenix's zoned acres allowed multifamily compared to 1% in Goodyear, Queen Creek, and Surprise. I will vote yes because I want to stay within the state law, but I'm not really happy with it, Councilwoman Laura Pastor said. Councilman Carlos Galindo Elvira was the only one to vote no, calling the state law a disservice to responsible development that silenced residential input. O'Brien said, "No amount of zoning laws will create more product if we do not address the market issues preventing some of these types of housing from coming in. Perhaps the state legislature should focus more on deregulating the market instead of punishing cities who have been doing the right thing." Stark said she was voting yes to avoid financial penalization from the state. If cities act out of compliance with state law, lawmakers can file complaints to the state attorney general. If the attorney general agrees the city violated state law, the cities can lose state shared revenue, a significant portion of funding that would affect public safety, human services, parks, and libraries, for example. Hodge Washington said she hopes the legislature works more collaboratively with Phoenix in the future rather than move toward with these preemptive notions. State Senator Anna Hernandez's law was about challenging all cities to do more. In October, Gallego blasted the state law as hypocritical for purporting to improve affordable housing while simultaneously exempting affluent cities like Fountain Hills and Paradise Valley. She said Phoenix's government affairs team and the Arizona League of Cities and Towns worked hard to negotiate on behalf of Phoenix regarding short-term rental concerns, but that the city's own legislators, for example, State Senator Ann Hernandez, pushed back. Hernandez, a co-sponsor of the state law legalizing casitas, told the Republic if the mayor and council were concerned about which cities were exempted from the law, they should consult their lobbying team. To say that certain cities were left out because lawmakers chose that path is grossly inaccurate, Hernandez said. The final versions of the bills were based on compromises that were made with the League of Arizona Cities and Towns. That's the table representing all 91 cities and towns in the state of Arizona. Hernandez said while she was very happy with the bill, she said she would have preferred if cities weren't exempted. The reality is the versions and negotiations we landed on is what was going to be able to pass, she said. You can contact Taylor Seeley at TSEELY@ArizonaRepublic.com or by phone at 480-476-6116. And her article was titled Law Forces City Shift on Casita Rules. You are listening to Hour 1 of the Arizona Republic for Friday, November 22nd, 2024. I'm your son, Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Joe Napoli. You can now take Sun Sounds with you. You can stream and get on-demand programs through our Sun Sounds of Arizona mobile app available for Android and iPhone. Next, Madeline Parrish brings us an article titled South Phoenix Residents Split Over News of Potential School Closures. Dozens of community members and parents reacted to news of potential school closures in South Phoenix's Roosevelt Elementary School District during a public hearing on Tuesday. Some gave impassioned pleas to halt the plan to shutter schools while others spoke in support of the plan, saying it was necessary for the well-being of the district and its students. Superintendent Danny Portillo proposed the closures in response to a years-long trend of declining enrollment and a multi-million-dollar budget deficit. She has said the closures would allow the district to steady its finances and improve academic outcomes for students. Portillo initially recommended the district close 6 of its 18 schools over the next 2 years, but she amended her recommendations after she and the board faced an outpouring of opposition to the potential closures during a meeting last week. Now Portillo is recommending the district close 5 schools before the 2025-26 school year: Martin Luther King Jr. Elementary, Maxine O. Bush Elementary, C.J. Jorgensen Academy of Service Learning, V.H. Lassen Academy of Science and Nutrition, and John R. Davis Elementary. In a letter sent to district families on November 18th, Portillo said that absent school closures, the district's only alternative will be to cut existing academic programs for all students and teaching positions across all Roosevelt schools, an option she said she cannot support. Board member Lawrence Robinson, who was first elected to the board in 2012, was the only board member to explicitly oppose the school closures on Tuesday. He told attendees that he thought the district could avoid school closures by cutting costs in other places: administrative costs, plant operations, instructional support, transportation, and food services. He said the district has successfully dealt with multiple budget deficits in the past. "If you want to close these schools, you're giving enrollment right to our competitors," Robinson said. He directed attendees to a website outlining his alternative solutions and a petition to stop the school closures. Robinson's term ends in January, along with 2 other board members. None of them ran for re-election. Roosevelt schools as a whole are at 56% capacity, according to a presentation Portillo gave at last week's governing board meeting. After the closures, the district would be 77% full, she said. On Tuesday, Portillo compared Roosevelt with the neighboring Levine Elementary School District. Levine has several hundred more students than Roosevelt, according to state enrollment data, but has half the number of schools. Roosevelt Elementary community split on school closures. On Tuesday, Sandra Melgar, a V.H. Lassen parent, told the board she didn't want her children's school to close. "I honestly feel like V.H. Lassen is family to me," Melgar said through tears, noting the school's community pantry and its partnership with a neighboring community garden, Spaces of Opportunity. The school has a special gardening and culinary focus. Melgar has 2 daughters, 3rd and 7th graders, who have both been attending V.H. Lassen since kindergarten, and said they have been dealing with emotional stress because they do not understand why their school has to close. She said her older daughter doesn't want to go to Ignacio Concho School, another Roosevelt Elementary school, and is asked to go to NFL YET College Prep Academy, a charter school, if V.H. Lassen closes. Alexandra Castarron, another V.H. Lassen parent, said she was worried about potential overcrowding. She said she thought parents from the closed schools might pull their kids from the district rather than send them to assigned schools, resulting in kids being separated from their friends. During the governing board meeting last week, several community members said the closures would erase important elements of South Phoenix history. 2 schools that would be impacted by the consolidation plan are named after John Davis and Ignacio Conchos, Phoenix police officers who were killed in the line of duty in South Phoenix in 1982. Rick Davis, John Davis's son, spoke Tuesday and appeared to be in support of the plan, despite the fact that his father's namesake school was slated for closure. "I am really big on repurposing my dad's school with his namesake," he said. "If we can come together and make a community center, that would be great. Let's move forward. There won't be any bulldozing of schools, just repurposing," Davis said. "There are a lot of charter schools in this area, so let's get strong." Yolanda Fernandez, Ignacio Concho's daughter, said the schools do mean a lot in the history and described the Ignacio Concho school as a true honor. Ignacio Concha School is not one of the schools slated for potential closure. It is set to absorb students from VH Lassen. Fernandez described the closures as something that has to be done. "We don't need to be fighting," Fernandez said. "This is our beautiful South Phoenix community." During Tuesday's meeting, Portillo said he does not want to sell the closed schools, but rather lease the buildings for uses that would benefit the community. She also said the teachers from the closed schools would be moving with the students to maintain class sizes. Some community members asked the board to delay the closures. Warren Stewart Sr., the senior pastor of First Institutional Baptist Church, requested the board wait until new members are seated in January before voting on the matter. "The community is not only grappling with the potential loss of these schools, but also the emotional toll it takes on our children and families," Stewart said. "The anguish surrounding the situation has been palpable." Other speakers, including some parents, said they thought the closures would be best for the students. "Buildings are not important," said Signia Oliver, a community member who attended Roosevelt and who serves on the Phoenix Union High School District Governing Board. "Names on buildings are not important. Kids are important." Terrence Kennedy, a pastor at Union Institutional Baptist Church, said there can be some positive to come from school consolidations. "If we are supposed to be one South Phoenix, what's the problem with Julian and King becoming one?" Kennedy said. Several speakers attempted to redirect the blame to the Republican-controlled Arizona legislature, including Tempe City Council member Bernadette Hodge. Democrat State Senator and incoming Phoenix City Council member Ann Hernandez and a representative from Save Our Schools Arizona, a public education advocacy group, opposed the universal expansion of education vouchers. Hernandez said that the legislature has, for years, undercut funding for public education, including by expanding the education voucher program and encouraging the proliferation of charter schools. "The district is not who you need to blame," said Hodge, who also serves on the governing board of the Tempe Union High School District, which voted in September to cut dozens of positions due to declining enrollment. "They have no choice about what funding is going to be taken." Another public hearing on the potential closures is scheduled for December 3rd. The board is scheduled to vote on the proposed closures on December 5th, which South Phoenix schools would close under the proposal. Portillo was set to recommend the following closures: close Martin Luther King Jr. Elementary and relocate about 240 students to Percy L. Julian School. Portillo said she plans to recommend turning King into an early childhood center with daycare and preschool, though nothing is set in stone. Close Maxine O. Bush Elementary and relocate about 300 students to Clove C. Campbell Senior Elementary. Portillo said she planned to recommend reopening Bush as a magnet school for the 2026-27 or 2027-28 school year. Close C.J. Jorgensen Academy of Service Learning and relocate about 240 students to Ed and Verma Pastor Elementary. Close V.H. Lassen Academy of Science and Nutrition and relocate about 260 students to Ignacio Concha School. Close John R. Davis Elementary and relocate about 330 students to Sunland STEAM Academy. You can reach the reporter at mparrish@arizonarepublic.com. And her article was titled, "South Phoenix Residents Split Over News of Potential School Closures." Our next article features a photo of Senator Mark Kelly. The caption reads, "Senator Mark Kelly speaks with volunteers during a campaign event for Kamala Harris at an IHOP in Mesa on October 16th. The article is titled, "Mark Kelly and Ruben Gallego on Trump's Nominees. Democrats Express Concerns About Picks," by Ronald J. Hansen. U.S. Senator Mark Kelly signaled his concerns with at least two nominees to the incoming Trump administration, citing worries about their qualifications and judgment, even as another pick withdrew. On Wednesday, Kelly, Democrat of Arizona, cited thin backgrounds for Pete Hegseth for Secretary of Defense and Tulsi Gabbard for Director of National Intelligence. He is a member of two committees that will screen their nominations for the Senate. Kelly and his seatmate in the next Congress, U.S. Senator-elect Ruben Gallego, Democrat of Arizona, were among those on Capitol Hill who intended to seek details of the matters that led to a years-long investigation into former U.S. Representative Matt Gaetz, Republican of Florida, who withdrew Thursday as President-elect Donald Trump's pick for Attorney General. Hegseth is a commentator for Fox News who served in the Army in the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. The Associated Press has reported that ahead of the presidential inauguration in 2021, Hegseth was flagged as a possible insider threat because of a tattoo popular with white nationalist groups. On the surface, for me personally, he's got a pretty steep hill to climb to prove to me that he's up for this job, said Kelly, who is a member of the Senate Armed Services Committee that will screen the nomination for the Senate. He's a young guy who has spent the last 9 years on a Saturday morning Fox News show, so I've got concerns. Kelly said Hegseth was a junior officer and probably didn't manage a lot of people, certainly didn't manage any kind of big programs or create policy. If confirmed, Hegseth would oversee the Pentagon's nearly $800 billion annual budget and 1.3 million active duty troops. Gabbard is a former Democrat who served 4 terms in the House from Hawaii and is a veteran of the National Guard who was deployed to Iraq. She has met Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and blamed the U.S. and its NATO allies into provoking Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has described Gabbard as a Russian asset. Kelly, who is a member of the Senate Intelligence Committee that will screen Gabbard's nomination, said she doesn't have a lot of intelligence experience. I don't think that necessarily eliminates somebody from consideration. This is who the president-elect wants in this job, so I'm interested in hearing her out. I'll have some questions about some decisions she has made in the past with regards to foreign contacts, but I'll give her a totally fair shake at being confirmed for this position. Kelly said he does not question Gabbard's patriotism, but I will likely have questions about her judgment. The process never went that far for Gaetz, who quit his seat in Congress last week just to have expected action by the House Ethics Committee. He won the election of the next Congress that begins in January, but it is unclear whether he wants to return or even can do so. A return can bring new scrutiny in the House to the probe that sank his role in the next White House. The committee probed allegations of sexual relations with an underage girl and illicit drug use, among other things. Republicans on the panel blocked releasing the committee's report on Wednesday, but Gaetz acknowledged he had become a distraction to Trump's plans for a new administration and withdrew before the matter went further. Earlier this year, the U.S. Justice Department said it would not file criminal charges against Gaetz in connection with allegations of sex trafficking. Kelly said that wasn't enough to sway him. Not charged with a felony isn't a qualification to be the Attorney General of the United States, he said. It's an important job. I think you want experienced prosecutors in there. I think Gaetz stands out from the other nominees as somebody who was probably chosen because of his loyalty to the president-elect. In my view, that's the opposite of a qualification. The president should be appointing people that they know will be completely independent and not because they pass any kind of loyalty test. Gallego indicated he, too, approached the Gaetz nomination with concerns. He's going to have to answer those questions, and if he answers those questions in a manner that's fit, I'll think about it. If not, then I'll exercise my duties under the Constitution of the United States for a review of nominees. Gallego said he was excited for some of the nominees, particularly U.S. Senator Marco Rubio, Republican of Florida, who was nominated for Secretary of State. I think it would be very exciting for me, being a first Latino senator. I would love to be able to support the first Latino Secretary of State if he hits all the marks, Gallego said. He said his criteria is whether someone will uphold the Constitution, whether they are good for Arizona, and help with the state's needs. Next, we turn to an article titled, County Approves $4 Million Settlement in Jail Death, by Jose R. Gonzalez. Maricopa County is set to pay out millions in a settlement with the family of a man who died in 2021 while jailed. The County Board of Supervisors voted unanimously on Tuesday to a $4 million settlement with the family of Akeem Terrell. The 31-year-old Phoenix resident was seen in security footage during jail custody on January 1, 2021, as officers trying to change his handcuffs descended on him. The ordeal unfolded in an isolation room Terrell was being held at in Lower Buckeye Jail in Southwest Phoenix. Terrell had been arrested for refusing to leave a New Year's Day party. A lawsuit was filed on December 30, 2022, on behalf of Terrell's family. The suit argued Terrell's civil rights were violated by actions taken by the officers and named Sheriff Paul Penzone, Maricopa County, the City of Phoenix, and city and county officers as defendants. Phoenix City Council voted on September 11th to an $800,000 settlement with Terrell's family. At one point, the video shows as many as 7 officers are seen atop Terrell in the isolation room before he is left restrained for several minutes prior to anyone performing CPR on him. According to the suit's lawyer, Jesse Showalter, Terrell was pronounced dead at a hospital the morning he was in custody after going into cardiac arrest. Terrell left behind a daughter. Video and audio suggest Terrell feared for his safety, asserting officers were lying about where he was and that they were trying to kill him. The lawsuit said he had a history of mental illness and stated before his arrest that he was expressing paranoid thoughts and said during his custody he was speaking almost constantly in a manner that would be consistent with mental illness. Republic reporter Jimmy Jenkins contributed to this report. Next, Karen Bartunek brings us an article titled, Attorneys for Tyrone McAlpin Plan to Sue the City of Phoenix. The legal counsel of 34-year-old Tyrone McAlpin, the deaf black man with cerebral palsy who was repeatedly tased by police, announced their intention to sue the City of Phoenix on November 19th. The notice of claim against the city is $3.5 million. McAlpin's attorneys said they will also be pursuing legal action against 3 Phoenix police officers for the events on August 19th, according to their statement. Racial profiling is one of the many claims alleged against Phoenix PD in the suit. On that day, Phoenix police officers Benjamin Harris and Kyle Sue responded to a trespassing call at a Circle K near Indian School Road and 12th Street. The white man they were asked to remove from the store claimed he had been attacked and pointed out McAlpin across the street. According to footage, Harris told McAlpin to stop and grabbed him within a few seconds. There was a struggle among the men, during which Harris used a stun gun McAlpin 4 times. The officers collectively punched him over a dozen times, video showed. After the beating, McAlpin's attorneys claimed the police officers filed false reports that alleged McAlpin had committed aggravated assault while another officer wrote McAlpin stole his own cell phone. As a result, McAlpin was in jail for 3 weeks and faced multiple charges that Maricopa County Attorney Rachel Mitchell later dropped. When video footage of the incident was released at the October 1st court hearing, public outcry and criticism from local leaders reached national levels of attention. The officers involved were put on paid leave as the investigation continued. The attack followed in the wake of a report released in June by the Department of Justice that concluded police in Phoenix is problematic in a number of ways. The report said the Phoenix Police Department systematically uses illegal excessive force. Republic reporters Jimmy Jenkins, Maritza Domingos, Miguel Torres, and Taylor Seeley contributed to this story. And we turn to another legal news story titled, Judge Reprimanded Over Arrest Warrant. Court Failed to Tell Man When He Should Appear by Sarah Lapidus. A Cochise County judge has been publicly reprimanded after a man spent 2 days in jail for failing to appear in court after the court failed to tell him when to show up. The Arizona Commission on Judicial Conduct, May 29th, issued a public reprimand against Cochise County Superior Court Judge David Thorne for issuing a warrant for the arrest of William Pound. A public reprimand is a public sanction against a judge who has acted improperly, but not serious enough to require discipline by the state Supreme Court. Pound was wanted in court about a case involving his deceased girlfriend's personal property. The woman's son, David Plummer, applied to be her personal representative. he requested a court order to demand Pound provide access to her items. As her personal representative, he had a duty to obtain and distribute her items and all other property in the estate, according to the minute entry of a hearing on April 9, 2023. Plummer alleged Pound repeatedly denied him access to her things, including two cats, jewelry, and other items. He claimed Pound told him he wanted to keep her things, according to court records. Plummer also claimed Pound contacted their mutual landscaper to remove and dispose of his mother's items following her death. He said Pound has multiple firearms and allegedly threatened to shoot him and his family, leading him to request an emergency order to secure the items as he was in fear for his safety. A court hearing was held about the request on June 7, 2023, but according to the commission's reprimand, Pound was not served with a notice to appear in court. He was also never issued a notice to appear for a subsequent hearing scheduled the following month. Days before the second hearing, the court sent a minute entry to Pound's address, but it didn't indicate he was expected to appear in court, nor explain the consequences if he failed to appear. At the second hearing on July 25th, Thorne asked Plummer if Pound had been served with a notice of the hearing. He replied no, and Thorne issued a civil arrest warrant for Pound. A week later, Pound was arrested and jailed for 48 hours, according to Pound's complaint. I am filing this complaint as I feel the Honorable David Thorne did not perform his duties as a judge of Cochise County Court and had me arrested for contempt of court in spite of evidence that I had never been informed of court hearings, Pound said in his complaint. The commission said Thorne violated three rules of the Code of Judicial Conduct. The first rule he violated states, a judge shall act in all times in a manner that promotes public confidence in the independence, integrity, and impartiality of the judiciary, and shall avoid impropriety and the appearance of impropriety. The second rule Thorne violated requires judges to perform judicial and administrative duties competently, diligently, and promptly. Last, the commission's reprimand said Thorne violated a rule requiring a court to every person who has a legal interest in a proceeding or that person's lawyer the right to be heard according to law. Thorne said he issued the warrant as a last result after several attempts were made to contact the man. I typically do not issue civil arrest warrant unless I am convinced that there are no other alternatives to get the litigant to comply with the court's orders, Thorne wrote. You can reach the reporter at sarah.lapidus@gannett.com. The Republic's coverage of Southern Arizona is funded in part with a grant from Report for America. Support Arizona news coverage with a tax-deductible donation at supportjournalism.ezcentral.com. And that's a wrap for Hour 1 of the Arizona Republic for Friday, November 22nd, 2024. I'm your volunteer broadcaster, Joe Napoli, thanking you for listening to Hour 1, encouraging you to stay tuned for Hour 2, and our other great programs here on Sun Sounds of Arizona.